In the Old Testament book of Ruth, it opens with these words. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled. And as you think about the setting of the book of Ruth being in the book of Judges, the book that immediately precedes Ruth, you see quite a contrast between these two books. Ruth is a very short book, a very brief story. It's a narrative, really. Judges, much longer, much more comprehensive. But in Judges, you find violence and idolatry and unfaithfulness and all sorts of terrible things that happen there. Someone I read once characterized the book of Judges as being said a little bit like in our own nation about 150 or so years ago in the old Wild West days, you know, when it was just kind of a really not a safe place to be, not the best place to be. Contrast that with what you read when you get to the book of Ruth. You read a story of love and tenderness. There's still some good people in the land in spite of all the difficulties that you read about and all the unfaithful people that you read about. And really, you know, when you read the last few chapters of the book of Judges, and you know, it doesn't tell us exactly the time frame that the book of Ruth fits into in the book of Judges, because the book of Judges covers quite a long span of time. Some have said maybe as much as 300 years, but it's quite a long span of time. But it doesn't tell us exactly where Ruth fits in that time frame, but it's during the days when the judges ruled the land. But when you read the very last three or so chapters of the book of Judges, I tell you something. You read some of the most horrific stuff you read in almost all of the Bible. It's almost stomach-turning how disgusting some of the sinful behavior the people has deviated to in those last few chapters of Judges. And what a relief, if you're reading through the Bible, what a relief to come to Ruth, this sweet, gentle story that is so very different from what you just read. Such a contrast and such a blessing to have this book in the Bible. It's only four chapters. It's a very small book. You know, there's 66 books in the Bible. There are some that are shorter than the book of Ruth, but it's kind of interesting when you look at all the names of the books of the Bible. You know, some are named after the author. Some are named after the main character. Some have general names. You've only got two books, though, in the Bible that have female names. Ruth, that we're studying now, and the book of Esther, both of them in the Old Testament. Both of them are relatively small books. Both of them, you might say, neither one of them really contain any what you might call major doctrinal teachings that are supplements to the law of Moses or the law of Christ or anything else that God laid down. They're really just narratives. And so it's up to us to look at those books, and we're going to look at Ruth today, to see what we can learn and apply to our lives based on what the law of God really is. And I think you'll see that Ruth, and you can make that application of Esther too, study that on your own a little bit, but especially as you look at Ruth today, there are no small books in the Bible. There might be short books as far as the number of words, but there are no small books in the Bible. There are no small teachings in the Bible. There are no insignificant books in the Bible. There are no insignificant people in the Bible. There are no insignificant stories in the Bible. Because the book of Ruth is just a story. It's a narrative. But it's so full of meaning and significance. And so we're going to just sort of overview the book today with about four different points that will help us perhaps to remember what we're looking at here. We're going to base it on the character of Ruth. She's not the only person in the book, but she does have a significant story that we need to hear and learn a little bit about. And I think when it's all said and done, we can make some great applications and maybe take away from this tremendous book some great lessons. We begin with number one, and that is Ruth's sorrow. Ruth's sorrow. You may recall from the book, and we'll not read it in its entirety this morning out loud during this lesson, but you may recall in this book that Ruth married into family that had come from Israel. And there was a very sad thing when you read about this family that came from Israel. It says, when we go back to verse 1 of chapter 1, that there was a famine in the land. And that Elimelech, his wife Naomi, and their two sons decided to leave the land of Bethlehem, the place of Bethlehem, which ironically means house of bread, but there's a famine there. And so they leave. And they go over to Moab. You may recall that Moab is a bitter enemy, for the most part, of the nation of Israel, the people of God. And there have been problems prior to this with Moab and God's people. There will be more problems after this between Moab and God's people. But that's where they go. And it is there that Ruth is introduced to this family and finds this family, and she marries one of the sons. Well, over the course of a few years after the family stays there, some very sad events all kind of take place. Elimelech dies. Both sons, by the way, who had married women in Moab, the married women of the place of Moab, both sons die. And so it boils down to Naomi. She's lost her husband. She's lost both her sons. And it's Naomi and her two daughter-in-laws. Naomi decides after a number of years to return back to Israel. And her daughter-in-laws want to go with her, but she does not let them. But you see Ruth's sorrow in all of this. She's married into this family. She's young. She has a husband. Her father-in-law dies. Her husband dies. Her brother-in-law dies. Her mother-in-law, Naomi, is greatly wrapped in the grief and the sorrow that is all surrounded with this. And so, you have in this first chapter, really, all of that compounding itself together. And Warren Wiersbe has suggested an outline for this first chapter based on 3 points that all have the letter D in common. And they're all about something that was done wrong. There's in here a wrong decision, a wrong direction, and a wrong disposition. And by a wrong decision, we see that perhaps it was not very wise for Elimelech to take his family into Moab, some of the enemies of God's people. And in regard to the wrong direction, when Naomi finally decides to return back to Israel, and her daughter-in-laws want to go with her, she says, no, you just go back home. And you must realize that although Israel had its great share of problems and idolatry was often rampant in the land, Moab was characterized by idolatry. And Naomi, imagine this, Naomi is trying to send her daughter-in-laws back to idolatry, where it's an absolute, and really doesn't try to encourage them in their faith. So Naomi is the one who's sending them really in the wrong direction, not a spiritual direction. She's hurt, she's bitter, there's so many things, and that's really what the third wrong is about, the wrong disposition, that Naomi looks at all of this with such bitterness. The name Naomi has in its inherent meaning something that is quite sweet. In fact, it means pleasantness. But when she returns to the land, and people see her once again after her long absence, they say, isn't it Naomi? And you may recall what she says, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. And while the name Naomi means pleasantness, the name Mara means bitterness. And so her disposition, I'm sure, tainted the direction she wanted to send her daughter-in-laws. One daughter-in-law did return, but not Ruth. And even though Ruth has much of the same sorrow, much of the grief also to deal with, she will, as she states so eloquently in chapter 1, cling to her mother-in-law and her people will be Ruth's people, and her God will be Ruth's God. And she'll be faithful to her and faithful to this new direction she'll take with her life. But chapter 1 really is characterized by the sorrow. Ruth's sorrow and the sorrow of Naomi, even indirectly as we see it in the chapter, by her changing her own name. But then you move to chapter 2. And in chapter 2, after seeing in chapter 1 Ruth's sorrow, in chapter 2 you see Ruth's service. She does not come to this new home and to this new land with the intention of just sitting back and doing nothing. Now there are two more D's really that you can look at that would describe Ruth in chapter 2, and that is dedication and determination. Ruth has now this resolve in her heart that fills her with dedication to her mother-in-law, her family, her new land, her new God, her new faith. But she also has a determination that she will not sit around and just become bitter. She will not sit around and only focus on what she has lost and only have that sorrow and heartache and grief to completely consume her. She will have a determination. You know, she's come back poor. I don't think she ever had that much to start with, really. But she's come back very poor. And there's very little for her. And if she is to provide for herself, she cannot rely on a husband at this point. And so any food, any shelter, any clothing, anything that she might have, she must be determined to find that herself. And with this spirit of determination and dedication, she moves forward. And in chapter 2, you see God's providence. Just like in the book of Esther we mentioned a few minutes ago, you see God's providence. You see God's providence here as we talk about Ruth's service. Being poor, she goes out to one of the richer landowners and gleans in his field as the law of Moses prescribed that the poor could glean the remnants of harvest and that they could have something to eat. And providentially, this is not just coincidence, okay? Providentially, God puts her in Boaz's field. And there Ruth will come face to face with the very man that God has chosen to redeem her and marry her. This would not have happened had it not been for her dedication and determination. But God will use Ruth, a Moabitess, a non-Israelite, a Gentile, in His great plan. We'll see that a little more as the lesson progresses. But I think you see, as we think about Ruth's service, that God does not bless lazy people. God does not bless people who don't have determination. God does not bless those who do not have dedication. That's not what we find in Ruth at all. And there's some tremendous words that you read in this chapter that we see God's providence all kind of wrapped around, because in spite of the sorrow, in spite of the difficulty, in spite of all the negative things that we could address here, look at some words that pop up in this particular chapter. When you look here in verse 2, you see that it talks about God's grace. You see that it talks about God's favor. In verse 13, it talks about God's favor. In verse 20, it talks about kindness. And you see how Ruth is dealt a very difficult situation. She's a widow. She's a foreigner. She's living with a mother-in-law who's really living in a very dark period of her life. She has no income. The possibility of starvation is imminent. But God will take that situation because of Ruth's service and change it into something remarkably much more beautiful. And that's why sprinkled throughout this chapter you find the words grace and favor and kindness in contrast to all the darkness that could have been there. And so with Ruth's service, God will use the Gentile, Ruth, to once again restore Naomi's blessings that had been lost because of the death of her family. You know, it's kind of interesting, these two books that bear female names in the Bible. The book of Esther, you've got a Jew who marries a Gentile and ends up blessing God's people. And in the book of Ruth, you've got a Gentile that ends up marrying a Jew and ends up blessing God's people. And much of this is tied to Ruth's service. But then, chapter 3, Ruth's surrender. Ruth's surrender. When Naomi was returning to Israel, she told Ruth that she would find rest among her own people, the Moabites. But now, Ruth is finding rest not there, but among God's people. And you've got this development of the situation between Ruth and Boaz, where God is providentially orchestrating. This is not just coincidence, but God is providentially orchestrating everything to where Ruth will be able to find a new husband, a new home, a new family, and all involved in this will also be Naomi. You see, we got to remember the law of Moses and the inheritance and the tribal allotments that these people had were based on the family clans. And in this particular case, Elimelech had his inheritance. He had his land as part of the greater family clan, as part of the tribe. But then he died. It would have been left to his sons, but what happened to both of them? They died. Elimelech's descendants ceased, in essence. And so his allotment, his inheritance, would then transfer to the next of kin, in essence. Unless someone was willing to redeem it on behalf of Elimelech and his sons. This is where Ruth comes into play. Because she's the widow, under the law of Moses, she's the widow of the deceased son, the rightful heir. And unless someone was willing to marry her and raise up children on behalf of her deceased husband's inheritance, it would all be lost and forfeited. It would stay within Israel. But Naomi would have nothing. And God will use Ruth to restore that blessing that Naomi had lost to her once again. But it's only because Ruth is willing to be a part of God's plan and work in God's great plan to see that these events will indeed take place. And there's a bigger picture here, and so she surrenders herself to all that. There's a bigger picture here that you've got to see here too. Because as we look further in the book, we will learn that Ruth will have a descendant a couple of generations away, that someone very famous that we know very well in the Bible, a man who would become king known as David. And so as we think about that, we might say, well, that's quite interesting. But you see, there's something deeper here. Because it's not just about David. Because ultimately, who would descend through the seed and lineage of David? The Messiah, Jesus. You see, God is orchestrating the plan to bring the Messiah into the world. And we are at a juncture here in human history, in chronology, where the possibility of that occurring, strictly from a human viewpoint, is cut off, in essence. Is endangered of being completely squashed. God will allow a kinsman, Boaz, to raise up seed, an inheritance, for those who have died, that the lineage may continue, and that ultimately one day the Savior would be born. And it hinges on Ruth's surrender and Ruth's willingness to be part of God's great plan. I don't think Ruth understood the great master plan that God had at that moment. I don't think Boaz understood it. But now you and I, looking back on it, can see it. And we can thank God for Ruth's willing spirit to marry Boaz and the events that then unfolded that relate directly to our salvation. This is not an insignificant book in the Bible. And it is Ruth's surrender, but then chapter 4, point number 4, Ruth's satisfaction. Really, we might in one sense say salvation. Her salvation, her satisfaction. Because you see, there's a potential monkey wrench in the situation. Boaz is the kinsman of those who have deceased, of Ruth's dead husband. But there's a kinsman who is closer. And he would have the first right of redemption, not Boaz. And so Boaz must diplomatically handle this situation because by this point, he is head over heels in love with Ruth. And by the way, when you read this story and you begin to see Naomi's role in it, you begin to see her moving back from bitterness once again to pleasantness. You begin to see Naomi coming to life again, seeing what's happening to Ruth and with Boaz. And so Boaz approaches the situation where matters like this are dealt with. And he says, you know, that I want to purchase this land and to raise up seed on behalf of our deceased kinsman. But I'm not the first in line for it, and that would be you. And he's not named. There's an unnamed redeemer, kinsman, who has, you know, the first right of redemption. And he says, well, I'll buy it. Because he's seen that as a good business deal in one sense. But then Boaz pulls out his little sneak attack there, his little trump card with Ruth, and he says, well, you also got to marry Ruth, the widow of our deceased kinsman. And the unnamed kinsman here suddenly sees his, what he thought was a good business deal, kind of become a bad business deal, because if he marries Ruth, he will have to raise up a child instead of Ruth's deceased husband, and what will that do to his inheritance? Well, he'll not have quite as much as he thought he would. And so he just sort of backs off and says, never mind. Boaz then steps up, because now he has first right of redemption. And he, because he loves Ruth, it doesn't matter to him about his inheritance. And he, because he loves Ruth, it doesn't matter that he's going to raise up a child, not so much in his name as in the name of his deceased kinsman Ruth's husband, Naomi's family, Elimelech's family, because of his great love for Ruth. None of these things matter. And so here we see Ruth's satisfaction, Ruth's salvation, because Boaz was willing to pay any price to redeem the woman that he loved. The unnamed kinsman was unwilling to do that. He was unwilling to, because any child that Ruth would bear would not carry his name. Boaz was willing. And he was willing to take that opportunity and willing to make Ruth his wife just because he loved her. And in the person of Boaz as the kinsman redeemer, we see a picture of Jesus as our kinsman redeemer, who was willing to pay any price to marry his bride, the church. Why? Because he loves her. Just like Boaz loved Ruth, Jesus loves his church, his bride. And here we have a book that began with a funeral and ended with a wedding, that began with death and ended with new life and birth. Here we have a book that opens with famine and closes with fullness and satisfaction. Indeed, there are no insignificant stories in the Bible. And so, let me make a few observations as we close this out of some practical lessons that we can learn from this tremendous little book. Number one, practical lessons. Number one, no matter how difficult the situation may be, God will see us through. Naomi, Ruth, they were dealt some pretty heavy hands. They were dealt some pretty bad cards. It was difficult. But no matter how difficult the situation would be, God would see them through. And Naomi would go from pleasantness to bitterness, and then from bitterness back to pleasantness. Number two, practical lesson. Number two, no person is outside of the reach of the grace of God. Ruth was from the country of Moab, one of Israel's classic enemies, a pagan nation. No doubt she had a pagan family. But that didn't make her outside of the reach of God's grace when she learned about God from Naomi and the family. And she believed in God. And she made up her mind to follow God and to be faithful to God. You see, no person is outside of the reach of God's grace. Ruth, it may have seemed like, had everything against her. But God saved her because of her faith and her willingness to be faithful. Practical lesson number three. It really does not profit us to get angry at God and blame God for our circumstances. Naomi and Elimelech, we might could say, made a bad decision and they went into a pagan land, and consequently while they were there some bad things happened. Naomi, it seems, at least for a period of time, took out her frustration and her anger on God. And I guess it's a little bit natural for humans to do that. But really, God was not to blame. The circumstances were not pleasant. They were not fun. They were not great. But God was not to blame. And through Ruth's constant dedication, her willingness to stand by Naomi's side, her willingness to make Naomi her own mother, Naomi saw, I still need God. God is helping me, not hurting me. I may be hurting, but it's not God who hurt me. God is helping me. Practical lesson number four, there are no small decisions with God. Just like there are no insignificant or small books of the Bible, there are no small decisions with God. Ruth made a decision one day to go glean in a field. I don't think it was coincidence. It was certainly not a small decision because providentially God brought her into the very presence of the one who would redeem her, marry her, give birth to children, King David, ultimately, through that lineage, Jesus the Messiah. There are no small decisions with God. And so as you and I make our decisions, let's remember that. Every decision we make has the potential of being, eventually, a big decision. There are no small decisions in God's sight. And practical lesson number five, it is wise to wait on the Lord. It is wise to wait on the Lord and see how He's going to work things out. That does not mean that we sit back and we do nothing. That does not mean that we sit back and we don't care. That does not mean that we sit back and, like Naomi, say, call me bitter. We do all that we can. And when we have done all that we can, we trust in God to do all that He will. And it's wisest to sit back and wait on God. And I think the book of Ruth demonstrates that in a very beautiful, beautiful way. And so with this small book just briefly studied this morning, I hope it's an encouragement for each and every one of us as we think about the God of Ruth, who is, by the way, still our God. That God who loved, that God who cared, that God who in the book describes certain things with grace and favor and love, that God is still our God. And that God who saved Ruth back then from what potentially was a pagan lifestyle and a lifestyle that would lead her in a very bad direction, that God is still our God. And that God can still save us. When we, through the descendant that we ultimately know about from Ruth and Boaz, Jesus the Christ, hear Him, believe Him, and obey Him, God can save us too. And so believe in God. Believe in His Son. Believe that God loves you. Believe that God is wanting to work things out for your life for what is the very best. And be faithful to Him. Surrender your life to Him. Die to your sin. Be buried in the waters of baptism. Rise from those waters to be added to the bride of Christ that He purchased with His blood, that He loves then, that He loves now, that He will love through all eternity when judgment day comes. And the faithful are told, well done, good and faithful servant. This morning, if you need to obey the gospel, if you need to be restored, if you need prayers, we encourage you. Please come while we stand and we sing.